Hi, my name is Patricia Kathleen, and this podcast series will contain interviews I conduct with female and female-identified entrepreneurs, founders, co-founders, business owners, and industry gurus. These podcasts speak with women and women-identified individuals across all industries in order to shed light for those just getting into the entrepreneurial game, as well as those deep in the trenches. Histories current in companies and products and lessons learned are explored in the conversations I have with these insightful and talented powerhouses. This series is designed to investigate a female and female-identified perspective in what has largely been a male-dominated industry in the United States to date. I look forward to contributing to the national dialogue about the long overdue change of women in American business arenas, and in particular, in entrepreneurial roles. You can contact me via my website, patriciakathleen.com. Thank you for listening. Now let's start the conversation. Hi guys, welcome back. This is Patricia Kathleen, continuing our podcast series. And today I am so excited to be sitting down with Eileen Zimmerman. She is founder and CEO of Wander Wet Bags, which is a swimsuit bag company. And she is also the principal and founder at Traction, a product development and marketing strategy consulting firm. Eileen's a seasoned product leader with a 15-year career built in helping and innovating innovative companies bring the right products to market and win new customers. She's highly analytical and creative as a marketing strategist. So welcome, Eileen.
Thanks so much, Patricia, for having me.
Thank you. I cannot wait. Actually, your product is so exciting to me because it's near and dear to my own life. So I can't wait to kind of jump into Wander Wet Bags and the whole story behind it. Really quickly for our audience who's listening, a roadmap of today's interview with Eileen. We're going to cover some academic background and initial professional career, and then we're going to get into the current businesses and titles they're in, and then questions regarding wet bags and maybe some information about Traction and things of that nature. Then we're going to talk about Eileen's goals for wet bags over the next 3 years, and we will wrap it up with advice that she has for those walking in her shoes or trying to get involved. So let's dive right in. What is your academic background and your early professional experience?
Sure. So I grew up in San Francisco Bay Area, and I went to undergrad at UC Irvine. I studied economics. I actually thought I was going to study psychology, but when I was there, I realized that I probably wanted to do something with business later, so I thought I should prepare myself for business school. So I switched from sociology to economics and graduated with that degree. Spent some time in the workforce, and we can talk more about that in a second, but then I went and got my MBA from Santa Clara University, also up in Silicon Valley.
Oh, great. That's a cool school.
It is. It's a great school. Highly recommend.
Nice. And so after your MBA, did you immediately launch into a business career, or did you kind of look around?
Yeah, so I started in between my undergraduate and MBA program. I started my career in sales and business development. So my entire career has been spent either working with startup companies or Fortune 500 companies or anywhere in between, helping them create and or sell new products. So whether I was at a startup and they had a new product, or is that, you know, Yahoo early in my career back in the day, mm-hmm. it was with them in a new department that they were starting a kind of different process within their organization, and I was part of that. So my whole career has been focused on new products and bringing them to market.
That's fantastic. That sounds like such a, like every moment you have is a breath of fresh air. You know, new products in any company is kind of the darling child, right, of what's happening.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is, from the outside perspective, what I've learned is there has to be an appetite for new at the company, a really a culture of innovation for products to work at big companies, because a lot of times there's so the longer the company has been around, the harder it is to make changes because people are really wed to the current way of doing things, mm-hmm. and there's so much more risk from a financial company from the company's perspective. There's like more financial risk, like, oh, if we make this change, we might lose millions of dollars. So
right.
it's kind of a different game at big companies, but for sure, there's never a dull day when you're dealing with innovation.
Yeah, and I guess that's true. I think that every time I hear of a new product launching, especially the larger, like, titan companies like Amazon, Netflix, Yahoo,
any of the internal grumblings have always been like based around unrealistic expectations that the initial product even had. You know,
right.
There's this idea that something's going to launch in 6 months and, you know,
right.
a year and a half later, everyone's kind of sweating over it. So I think there is that element too that I hadn't really considered with that new product innovation. So you did a bit of that, and then what brought you to your current endeavor? Were you dabbling in different fields, or were you working with companies like Yahoo for a while?
Yeah, so I've kind of toggled back and forth between my own consulting practice and working in corporate, depending on where I was in my life with raising kids and times when I had the ability to be more flexible. So I started Traction, my product development consulting practice, over a decade ago, and I was working at the time up in Silicon Valley with early stage startups and really helping them get their messaging together and how that they could pitch, like engineers could pitch the products that they were developing to their first customers. And then I also moved down here to San Diego and I worked for some of the tech companies here as a product manager, helping develop the products and then again work on the messaging and get those first products out. So I spent 15 years doing this, and I got to a point where I had a great job. But I was doing an hour and a half commute round trip
wow.
every day, and my kids were really little. They were 3 and 5. My older ones started kindergarten, and it just got to the point where I'm like, you know, I need something different. Something, one of many factors needed to change to make it a better situation. I kind of got to the point where I felt like I was a jammies mom, in quotations,
yeah.
where I'd leave in the morning at 7 and my kids would be in jammies, and then I'd get home, like leave work at 6 and get home at 7 and my kids would be in jammies. I'm like, you know, I've got this great career and I've built this life and I don't feel like I get to enjoy it. So I just
right.
had thought I was going to go back to consulting again, and ended up through serendipity creating this swimsuit bag company, and here we are.
So what happened? Was there an impetus? Was there a night when, you know, you were stumbling upon a rock and suddenly it occurred to you, or did it come through like actual experience? Like, how did this idea come to you?
Great question. So living here in San Diego and by the beach, you know, the beach is just a reality every day
mm-hmm.
or every week. You've always got something wet with you, or even if you're just going to the gym, it's a very active culture. So I think I was literally at the beach having breakfast one day, and I saw someone that the bag said wet bikini bag. I'm like, oh my gosh, that is such a good idea. Like, I need one of those.
Yeah.
So I went and Googled and I did all the searching I could to find it. And when I finally found that bag, it didn't feel like it was made of the best materials, and
mm-hmm.
up close, it didn't look as cute as I thought it was going to look. And I just thought that there could be something better. The more I searched, there was nothing else except black utilitarian bags, like
yeah.
military grade.
Mm-hmm.
And so with my 7th grade sewing skills, I literally had not sewn since like 7th grade.
Excellent.
Yeah, I was like, it's a square. How hard can that be? And I made myself one. I was still in corporate. You know, it was just summer, you know, before I started the business. And I made one for myself, and people just started kind of asking about it. And I was like, there's something here. The more people asked me about this product I made at home by myself than many of the startups that I'd worked with that had engineering teams that worked on things for a year.
Yeah,
I'm like,
sure.
This thing has more traction than most of the tech companies
yes.
that products that I have worked on. And I'm going to just kind of check it out and see. And there was, and here we are.
Yeah, definitely. So when you launched it, did you take any capital? Did you bootstrap? Like, how? So let's start with wet bags. So that's how it launched. How many years have you had it around?
Sure, almost 4 years now. So a little over 3.5 years.
Okay, and then when you first started, did you immediately go for investment? Did you try bootstrapping it? Because when you get into a product, you know, there's initial costs up front, right?
Yeah.
For production and placement. Did you go to just boutiques? Did you strictly online first? How did that work?
Yeah, great question. I've bootstrapped the entire thing to date. So
nice.
One thing that has been very valuable to me from my tech career has been the concept of lean startup, which I don't know how much that's proliferated beyond tech, but the concept of like starting with an idea and really testing it offline
yes.
before you even launch anything or build anything. So that's what I did. I had like one bag and I just went and showed different, I think I finally made like 5 or 10, and I went and showed retailers and I asked friends, but I didn't tell them that I made it, to get all sorts of feedback from a lot of people. And I really just kind of self-funded as I went. Mm-hmm. The bigger I've gotten, that's been a bigger struggle because growth has been very fast. And so now I'm kind of rethinking, do I want to keep bootstrapping or do I want to kind of look for investment to fund the growth that I'm experiencing right now? But I've definitely grown it all organically.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think that the climate, as far as I've, you know, experienced over the past couple of years in San Diego and then again in Silicon Valley, yeah, even in Sweden recently, the idea is bootstrap, you know, keep bootstrapping as much as possible. I just think that for industries like yours, you can do that, you know, or friends and family kind of investment for so far or for so long. But yep. At some point, like when you hit growth, there is there's a very delicate balance,
yes.
Right, between meeting that growth potential and taking investment or not taking investment. I mean, I think it's, and there's different kinds of investment, of course, you know.
Exactly.
I was reminded just the other day that there's loans and things like that. You don't have to get into bed with a VC or an angel.
Yes.
But it is that kind of a, you know, it's great news, but it's also a bit of a query, you know, as to where you pivot and how you make that look. So with Wet Bags, did you, over the past 4 years, what has been your strategy as far as, like, did you try specifically to grow small? Did you always have, we're sitting in your office space right now, and did you always have a space? Did you start it out of your garage? Like, how did that work?
Yeah, I literally started at my dining room table with my little sewing machine mm-hmm. that my yeah. mother-in-law had given me at some point and made it and was working there. And then I took over one of my son's rooms and they moved into a room together. And we talked about that as a family, the little 3 and 5 year olds, like, yeah. Can mommy use your room for a little while and then I'll give it back. So, went from the small room to the big room. And finally I had literally taken over the living room and dining room of my downstairs. Mm-hmm. And it was just not, feasible to be using that space. So I moved here almost a year ago now. And so now we have the showroom because sometimes people do want to come in person. Mostly I do everything online or through partners, but I do have the showroom so people can come by, and my warehouse is here and my R&D kind of sample space is here too.
Right. And how many employees do you have right now?
I have 3 to 5 team members, kind of all of them are part-time and they work for me in different capacities. I've really been thoughtful working by myself and how I can outsource, all here in San Diego, but outsource business to people who are experts in their fields that I know that either I don't know it as well or it's something I know I can easily depend on someone else to be able to do, since I am only one person and I'm resource limited and time is my most valuable thing. Mm-hmm. So I have a really strong extended team, but like 3 to 5 women who work with me on a regular basis.
What would you say the most powerful ROI for, you know, outsourcing a task would be? Is it, you know, is it handling? I mean, it sounds like you're the marketing end of it. So what is the most powerful return on investment that you've kind of outsourced to your team members that's really paid off since you're not touching that?
That's a great question. Well, for sure, right away, scaling. And again, I my philosophy, for better or worse, is I do it myself until the point that I have mastered it and I can train someone else to do it, or until it's no longer feasible that I just don't have the time and capacity to do it myself, or I don't have the skill set. So I think right away, I was sewing everything myself for a while, and really quickly, within the first 3 to 6 months, I had more orders than I was able to sew. Mm-hmm. And so that was the first thing that I did, is outsource manufacturing, again, all here in San Diego. But that was a really big process, and I went through, I think I probably interviewed 15 different manufacturing facilities at this point, but I have like 2 to 3 that are really strong, that are true partners that I absolutely love working with. Mm-hmm. So being able to depend on someone else to have the same quality and level of product that I am comfortable taking to market has been, it's so valuable. I can't even describe. I wouldn't be able to do my business if I didn't have those partners.
Right. And when you first started, you said you took it to some boutiques and retail stores. Did you try an Etsy store or any online component in addition to the in-person, or did you want to keep it just in-person?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Part of my testing when I first started about, you know, okay, are these just people who are friends of mine who happen to see it, that ask about it, that are interested?
Right.
Or is this really something that, you know, someone would buy if they saw it in a shop? So my first test on that was, again, going to friends that didn't know I had made them. I kind of said I was, through my consulting practice Traction, I was helping someone else whose product it was.
Yeah.
So I got that feedback. And then I went to the retailers and boutiques and got their feedback. And I wanted to see, okay, is it only people who've seen them in person? And I'm like, I'm going to put one of these up on Etsy and see if someone will buy it without ever having spoken with me or seen it in person. And I think it took a month or so. I didn't do any marketing or anything. I literally just popped it up there with some photos. And like within a few weeks, someone bought it. I'm like, oh my gosh, this thing could work. Mm-hmm. And the first bag was bought by someone in Alaska, which blew my mind. I was like, oh my gosh, this could be bigger than I thought.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was really valuable, having a marketplace that existed that I could kind of test on.
And work with.
Yeah.
So over, you've grown this far and you're looking at scaling. What is your goal? Could you have, I mean, you're hitting a growth period, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have like a clear perception as to how you want to? I've talked with founders who say, I really try to stifle that growth. You know, I did that in the beginning because I didn't want to go too fast and burn out and be, you know, have the equity go down. And then I've talked with people that say, you know, I mean, not even me speaking with people, Susie or Mon, you know, that expand, like do what you need to do. So what is your, I guess, the next 3 years scaling looking like? How much control are you going to do with it? What do you plan on?
That's a really interesting question. I think my plan is to continue growing to the point where I'm while I'm able to provide the same quality of product and quality of service that I do now. So definitely I've made strategic choices about the channels that I work, that I sell through, the partners that I take on, so that I know that I'm continuing to be able to provide that level of service. So some channels and some partners, you know, they might want, I've had a few different times people wanted, one person wanted like 50,000 bags, and how quickly they wanted it out and the quality of the product that they wanted. I said, you know, that doesn't really align. I thought about it, I didn't say this, but that doesn't align with really what I'm trying to do. And it was so,
right.
It was a really difficult decision because it was like, wow, that is unfathomable amount of money right now.
Sure,
and I'm
yeah.
like, just financing that will be its own, you know, challenge, like
yes.
let alone getting it done in the time frame and not knowing like how that will work afterwards and having to say no to a lot of existing business that I had to be able to make room for that growth.
Mm-hmm.
I ultimately ended up saying no, and that was probably the best decision that I made because it enabled me to grow so much faster and have stronger partnerships with the people that I did have. So I think it has been a balance. I've been trying to grow in a strategic way that I can do organically, but yet also, be able to continue to grow as well, right? So not
right.
stifling it, but also doing it at a pace, especially since I've worked for some, you know, high growth startups, and I've seen the pain that happens when you go from 50 to 500 employees in a couple years.
Yeah.
And that's a really scary thing. It sounds amazing, but to actually go through that and experience that is not something I necessarily want to do quickly again. So
yeah, and the disconnect, you know, I truly believe I've never met a product that didn't suffer or a service that didn't suffer with
right.
that kind of growth, you know, even if it restabilizes on the other side. And the company morale, I think, yeah, incredible growth is hard on a human body and a business alike.
Right.
You know, it's too much.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. And I do like the idea that your story is, you know, I think it's a powerful message for co-founders, founders, and entrepreneurs out there that one of your best stories is this kind of decline to this massive upfront initial order that looks like a windfall of, you know, of finance and freedom and success.
Right.
You know, to be able to kind of understand that, you know, your limitations at that point is interesting. So for the next 3 years, do you see the growth happening steadily under your tutelage and control, or are you opening it up? And also, how do you feel about further partnerships? Like, what are your stipulations that you put on people that you, I think in my head, I'm picturing boutiques and things like that. In San Diego, we have so many surf shops and
mm-hmm.
things like that. Do you want to grow those relationships to expand in number or just continue with the ones that you have?
Yes. The next 3 years, again, I'm trying to be really strategic in the partnerships and the channels that I select. I have really strong partnerships and margins that I've been working with in corporate
okay.
gifting. So mm-hmm. that has been a really successful channel for me. And I think one thing that I've noticed, it's the trend, is the decline in retail. And it sounds like you know, it's something everyone's talking about. It's almost cliche at this point. Mm-hmm. But when I look at from a vendor perspective, going into, you know, looking at going into a department store or in a large chain of stores, like smaller boutiques, but it's a chain, the bigger the store and the store brand, the more, the smaller the margin and the more work, forget the price alone, the more work that's expected. So I had a huge account that I got, and they placed a, you know, significant, but still small, but significant initial order. And I got a 50 page document of all the things that I needed to do, how to tag it, like exactly where to place the price tag on. It's like I was doing all of their work. So it literally would just like get to the warehouse, they put it on the shelf, and that was done. I'm like, wow, like I make more money like in a month of online than I will from this it's perceived to be amazing retailer.
Yeah.
And I think that's really driven, again, like I'm not doing things because it's what's always been done. I'm kind of doing things that feel right for where my business is and for where the market's going. And I optimize for relationships. And again, maybe that's different from other people, but I think it's so much more powerful to have a strong relationship and partnership with someone that we can grow together over time than it is to have these one-offs where you get a big order and you're doing all this work, but it's really so disconnected. And it's like, well, I need this much on this date and you have to send it. You have to do all this work. It's not fun for me, right? I left corporate so I could be doing something that was fun. And I made a commitment to myself really early on that I'm proud to say that I've really stuck with, is to work with people I like. And I think that
I like that. That's excellent.
And it helps me like extend my brand and keep true to my brand, right? So there are things that are important to me about quality and service. And I can usually tell pretty quickly if someone else is like on the same vibe about that. And it sounds funny because in business school and in corporate and in tech, it's all logic and data and numbers and this. And I've learned it's almost like having to reprogram myself to listen to my body and listen to, you know, my gut instinct and listen to my intuition about, does this person have the same values that I do? And it's very qualitative and it's very soft skill. And it's been a rework to figure out how to let go of that. Well, on paper, this looks like it's going to be a lot of units. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know what? But in reality, my stomach hurts and my whole body's tight. And it makes me anxious to think about sending this product. I'm like, I'm not doing it. So.
Yeah.
Counterintuitive, but that's the way I've been working.
Well, it yields tenfold in happiness, though.
It does.
I mean, I think
so does.
It sounds like such a useful piece of advice that so many of us don't take.
Oh, yeah.
You know, especially when you're hungry for a break or starting up and thinking, I'll work with just about anybody. Like, give me a job. You know, like that kind of, and that is the entrepreneurial effort. And this idea of saying, you know, I'm choosing, you know, to be happy over all of that, I think is powerful. It's probably made you one of the happier entrepreneurs over the past 3-4 years.
I have to say it's been really life-changing, like, and that perspective has carried over into my personal life. I'm so much more appreciative of little things every day, and because I'm so much more in tune about how I'm feeling about situations, it makes me so much more grateful, you know, about, I don't know, where we live and having a backyard I can sit in and the sun and like little things. It sounds really it just makes me really be more observant about how I'm feeling in every situation.
Yeah.
So it makes me happier in general.
I think occupational happiness is people constantly overlook it.
Yes.
I don't believe I know too many adults right now that really believe they need to be happy with what they're doing. They can feel successful. They can be okay with it. You know, they can not die going to work. But for people to say, I'm genuinely really happy with what I'm doing and how I'm doing it it's rare. So
right.
I think it would have to spill over into, you know, the pores of your skin.
Yeah.
It would just have to. So with the vendor, the online, do you see one of those taking off more? I mean, I'm interested in this dialogue that you have about, I think it's probably really accurate and fairly clever, the way that you've kind of paralleled the idea that, you know, that yes, the death of the shopping mall and things of that nature, which I don't truly believe there will ever be an absolute death of one, but the online, that's been brewing for a long time. This concept that they're kind of putting that strain back onto the vendors, you know, and making people sweat more for it is going to do the opposite, right? It's going to push more people, more vendors to just go to the online environment.
Exactly.
Do you see your online work going up because of that, or do you see it right now? Is it 50-50? Is online 60 and retail 40? How is that working?
My retail is almost zero. Like, I work with, again, I have a lot of really fantastic boutiques that I work with. I work with some resorts and spas. So those type of boutiques, I think, on more of an individual basis, and some, larger kind of corporate brands, hotel brands, and those type of things. But I think that the online and the corporate gifting is pretty much all my business. I really don't focus on retail at all, to be honest with you. I think exactly what you said. For so many years, I don't think retail is dead. I don't think that suddenly, all these malls, they're definitely having to rethink how they're selling and who they're selling to.
Gyms and all that going in.
Yeah, they're trying to make it a different type of experience. Then you no longer need to go. You can go to in person to buy something. You can get it and price shop everywhere else, right? So they have to rethink what they're doing. But I think for so many years, they had the power, right? Like, this is the only place you can sell. If you want to be successful as a brand, you have to be in our department store, you have to be in our chain store,
right?
And that's just not true anymore. Like, I'm making a fine salary and a fine living off of my website, Amazon, and some choice partnerships that I have. So having the flexibility to sell on Amazon or sell on a lot of these other kind of small specialized third-party sites, mm-hmm. aside from just my own website, it gives me so much more power over my price and my packaging and all sorts of other things that I have no control over, and even how I market the product, I have no control over when I hand my product over to a department store or a chain retailer, for example.
Right.
That why would I work with them when I can sell for more and arguably get to more people when I use Amazon or my own website?
Right. Now, do you handle all of the shipping for your online still in-house?
We are just transitioning that right now. So part of my team, a lot of what they do is the shipping and fulfillment, and mm-hmm. we are moving right now into outsourced fulfillment. So that's going to be huge.
In-house fulfillment sounds daunting.
Yes.
More than two packages and I'm lost.
Yes. It's been a ride. Like, it got to the point, it was insanity about a year ago, and that's when one of my team members came on to help me. And it's just been, then it got to the point where she couldn't do it by herself, and so we hired another person. So now we're to the point where, like, you know what, this is silly. I think because I had such strong, I'd say I had kind of a little bit of strong grip on the experience and the packaging and, making sure everybody got the right order and those types of things, I was really hesitant to outsource. But I found such a phenomenal, again, partner. It feels right. I went to a few of them. I'm like, I still was nervous about it. And this one, I was looking for someone who had more expertise than I did and who was more attention to detail about the quality of the product. Like, does this pass? Does this not? Does this little mark? I'm like, okay, these are my people.
Yeah, so. That's nitpicky enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I love, this is the second time now you've mentioned kind of vetting people.
Mm-hmm.
And this, again, is a common thread with, I think, people, young and old, entrepreneurs and startup founders, and even people sage in a business. You get so hungry to get the ball rolling. I think you kind of just go with the first or second,
mm-hmm.
company you speak with on every level. You end up kind of, why did you use that person? Oh, I don't know. I just, I was referred and that's who I bumped into. And it sounds like you're really taking the time to vet these companies. Did someone advise you to do that? Did you have a mentor that said you really want to look at these people, or did you always intuitively know that from business school? Where did that come from?
That's a really great question. That came about very early on within the first 6 months of the business. I had a horrible, horrible, like, nightmare story with my first manufacturer that I tried to work with.
Mm.
And I ended up losing somewhere between $2,000 and $4,000 on my first manufacturing run ever. Like, a huge name brand manufacturer up in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I was distracted by, again, the logic and the data. Well, they work with these brands and they're big and they're in LA and they seem like, but in my gut, the entire time I was there, I was like, oh, this doesn't feel right. Like, I don't like the fact that XYZ, I don't like the fact that they're never here when I have scheduled my time to come up here and they don't show, or, they were all these red flags that I just didn't listen to because if on paper it looked good, and B, it was easy. They were right there. I found them. They seemed willing to work with me. And so I was just going for it, right? So my brain overruled, like, again, my intuition about all these red flags I was feeling. But I just went with it because I was so, you know, I would was having a hard time finding manufacturer. I think after that experience, that was, and so early on, at the time, I remember being like, oh my gosh, people, so many people would quit right now. Like, so many people would quit right now. And I'm like, I am not quitting. There's no way I'm gonna let this, you know, and I'm so glad I didn't, because I remember saying, someday this 4,000 will be 400,000 and I won't care that I lost that, you know?
Yeah.
But I think having that experience so early on was really a gift.
Yeah,
that had me think about that, and that's why I've been so cautious about who I bring on board, who I work with, who I outsource to, because of that experience. Because it can go so much worse than you think it can go when you pick the wrong partner.
Being thoughtful, you know, and interviewing a bunch, and it sounds like, you know, it does work as well. It's not just interviewing a bunch and getting lost in a sea of resumes of not knowing, you know, that kind of a thing. It sounds like you really do click, you know, when you are thoughtful and you pay attention to those things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I think that they were a good educational expense. You should send them a thank you note one day when you hit 4 million.
I'm sure I will.
In revenue, or 20 billion. Thank you so much for that early education. Okay, so now we're going to climb into some advice. We have a lot of listeners who are both sage and just starting out. And this is everyone's favorite part from all the feedback we get. So I'm wondering if you could look back over the beginning of this startup, and what are the three things that you are so glad happened? And it can be good and bad, but things that your company would not be the same without those three things. What are they?
Okay. Let's see. The three things I come in. So I've already talked about the people, right? And the partnerships. I think above all else, stay true, be very mindful early, like at the beginning, what am I trying to achieve? Like, who am I building for? What, like, where do I want to play in the market? And what does that mean about the product or service I have to bring, right? Like, I thought at the beginning, actually, when I started, I was like, oh, I live in San Diego. I'm going to be in all the surf shops. As it turned out, it ended up, the product that I created ended up being a little bit of a different market than surf. It ended up being more resort and spa and, you know, gift than it was surf. There was just a different vibe about it. And that's because that's who I am. I'm more that vibe than I am surf. And so be authentic to yourself and true to yourself. And I think if you can realize that and understand that at the beginning, then that will help really, that really has helped guide the partners that I picked too. Another thing, let's see, something else. Gosh, I think the pieces of advice that I would give would be different. Like, I think at the beginning when I started, my husband and I were talking about it, and all my experience in tech, I said, you know, we got to be prepared. It's going to take 3 to 5 years before we're really going to be making money, right? And that, you know, that's everyone, all these articles that talk about overnight successes, and they do the analysis, like, actually, you know, it took 5 years before there were like the trials and tribulations before all of a sudden everyone was like, oh my gosh, it was like an overnight success. My advice is different now. When I think back to myself now, it's like set out for 3 to 5 years, and here coming on my fourth year, I'm like, 3 to 5 years, I definitely feel like I have, I've positioned myself in a specific market and people know my brand within that market. And so there is recognition. At the time, I am making money, but that's also where the growth hits. So I think you have to expect to be like, broke and working really hard for 3 to 5 years, but then for the next 3 to 5 years, what I'm looking like, it's really probably 5 to 10 before you're really seeing that big payoff. I think just because you're a name brand, and even in tech, like in 5 years, a lot of those companies still aren't making money and they're not paying themselves. So as someone who has self-funded, if I had a VC that had given me $5 or $10 million and I'd have a salary, right? It's a lot easier to do that, but just be prepared that it's going to take at least 3 to 5 years to really have, you know, the position that you're able to be, quote, successful. And then, but it's going to take beyond that, because I reinvest everything back into the business, you know, as opposed to paying myself.
Well, and I would argue with the VC route, like, at least this, it's 100% yours. You
correct.
Know, you can have a VC who is going to cut you a salary of usually a pittance and then take, you know, a scandalous amount of the money or the company for themselves, whenever it does have a payday. So
And I wouldn't change that at all.
It's a powerful mark. If you were looking back, what one thing would you have changed, even if it just would alleviate some stress or time or something over the since the beginning of the startup, if you thought back and thought, I could have done without that?
I think one thing I'm trying to get better at is sometimes I wait too long before I outsource or do something. Like, I put up with all the work a lot longer. You know, I said I kind of wait till I can no longer do it that way, which has been good. Again, it's driven by the fact that I'm paying for it myself, right? So I don't have a lot of cash. That is also maybe part of the advice, is that that's allowed me to be really, again, mindful and thoughtful and make the best decisions, because I know I have $1,000 or $10,000, whatever that amount is, and I have to make really wise choices about how I'm going to spend it. I'm not like, oh, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try that, I'm going to try these trade shows, I'm going to do these things. I'm like, okay, what is really going to work out? So I think the one thing I would say it to myself starting over is, you know, really when you can anticipate the need, like, don't wait till it's like super painful and you get angry and you want to quit. Right. Like, don't wait till you're exhausted and you don't even have the energy to look for a fulfillment company. Like, be like, you know, okay, I'm at 75-80% of capacity. I should probably start having these conversations. So maybe not waiting until it's an emergency.
Right.
And actually, but I think, again, that's a function of the fact that I'm bootstrapping more so than not knowing that I need to do that. But not, I think energy is really important, to preserve your energy as an entrepreneur. So, you know, don't burn yourself out and try to take care of these things maybe a little earlier than feels comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that always involves spending money, right? Like, I stayed at home probably longer than I should have before I got an office. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, I would have been so much more productive for the past 6 months if I just got the office and sucked it up and paid the rent, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's an example.
There's a huge amount of, you know, co-working spaces that are kind of speaking to that. You know, people saying, like, I'm competing with your, you know, living room sofa, but you're going to get more work done here.
Yeah.
That's that kind of message.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, what do you personally think about, so, you know, some of your rhetoric about not outsourcing as quickly and as much, and it being frugal because you're bootstrapping, but also it's been kind of a common thread between amongst the women that I've spoken to thus far about not outsourcing very quickly. And there's been a lot of, you know, theories thrown around by myself as well. You know, one of the ones that I find applicable, at least for women who have homes and families and things of that nature, is that, you know, they're used to doing a multitude of tasks, you know, and I don't want to get into sexist roles or anything, but the majority of women, I think, in America are still doing a lot of domestic work as compared to if they are with a male counterpart. These are just, you know, some of the data collected. But, and so I feel like, you know, if you're not outsourcing those things from the get-go, from your home, it, you carry that over into business. Oh, I'll just do that. I can do it faster. You know, I'll just get that done.
Yep.
And it adds up, and it ends up being, there was someone who just recently said at San Diego Startup Week, I can't remember who it was, but they said, founders should be working on the $5,000 an hour tasks and outsourcing the $20 ones. You know, and really understanding what those tasks are, it can increase your bottom line, you know, and it kind of ties in with that outsourcing thing. And that, do you think that there's a difference between men and women when it comes to outsourcing like that? Or is it just you are specifically for yourself?
Geez, I don't know if there's a difference between the men and women. I certainly...
Like whether or not that women outsource later, or do you have a bunch of friends who are female entrepreneurs, or...
I do.
Are you flagship?
No, I have a lot of friends. That's like kind of my core group at this point, is other women in the trenches like I am.
Do they outsource easily?
I think I'm probably a laggard on that side. I think a lot of people actually outsource and do those things more quickly than I do. So I tend to be conservative again on what I'm giving up. I still do, like, right early on, I outsourced my photography because that's not something I can do as well. I outsourced my SEO and a lot of that kind of stuff. So things I did, I think I was, I'm conservative on things that impact the product directly, right? So, but I'm not sure that I can... I see a difference in outsourcing from a gender perspective. Although, again, I even with my counterparts, I definitely listen to my gut and my intuition a lot more, I think, than other people do. So because I'm not just like going with somebody because it's easy. But then I see the whiplash. I see the backlash because of that, where I see my friends or, you know, whoever, like, oh, I found this company, like, I don't know, like, you know, like,
yeah.
I'm thinking about, well, have you thought about this? It's, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to move forward and see what happens. And it's like, oh my gosh, it becomes an emergency and disaster like 6 to 9 months from now. So
right.
I'm not sure. That's an interesting question.
Okay. And then one last question about the product itself. Are you the sole artistic director over all of it? And have you seen it branching out? Does it start to kind of manifest into different forms, or is it staying just, you know, with the core product itself?
Yes, I do all of the design myself. And that's a great question. I am working on another product that's going to be launching probably later this year, maybe early next year, right now as we speak. I'm really excited about it. I think one of the things I learned from tech, and I always kind of preach, is do one thing really well. Like, a lot of times people try to build a product that has all these bells and whistles and features, but the
yeah.
overall experience is mediocre at best.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd prefer to have an app that does, like, solves one problem really, really well. And that's been my approach, is, you know, I'm going to focus on making the most, like, a beautiful, reliable, like, bag that's going to be waterproof and protect everything in your suitcase from your swimsuit or other wet things. So that's what I've been focused on. And when I think about how do I extend that, I didn't want to do a Me Too product and just do something because other people do it. I think one of the things that's different about my product is that it's different from other things that are out there that are similar. So when I was going to make my next product, I'm like, I don't want to just make not a suitcase, but I don't want to just make a suitcase just because I should, and someone said I should, because if I should have more products, I want to be really thoughtful about what my next product is.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I feel like I can really hit it out of the park because I was thoughtful about what my next thing would be. I guess being thoughtful and thinking a lot about the strategy is a theme in this podcast.
It's your tagline. I like it. They say that true product developers and designers, it's like children. It's about
it's
every
so
3 to 5 years, they start to come up with a new mm-hmm. one, even though they swear they're not going to.
Yeah, that's interesting. But yeah, that's on track with my timeline. So.
Absolutely.
I think it's like a new business too, right? Every new product to me is a new business. So with the limited resources,
yeah.
do I have time and energy and money to be able to, like, market something new?
Yeah.
Or should I focus deep dive on where I'm at and get more people to learn about the product I already have? So
yeah. Time for your thoughtfulness on that one. I've been ending the series of the past few different interviews by asking, what is your favorite thing that you're going to be doing today?
Oh, definitely being able to be creative and doing some R&D on this product I'm working on. And I've been doing prototypes. I've been pretty frustrated over the past couple weeks, like, not getting it right, or it didn't come out the way I wanted. And I'm really, really close today. So I'm really excited to get back into my sample room and keep playing.
It is,
yeah.
It's
podcast and creative
podcast.
Development at the same time. My favorite things to do, talk to people and be creative.
Me too. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today, Eileen, and meeting with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Patricia.
Absolutely. And to all of you out there, remember, until we chat next, to always bet on yourself. Sláinte.